It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. We are your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 60 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Out at the airport, they are showing easterly winds at 7 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for a 50% chance of rain for the rest of the day and mostly cloudy skies, high near 61, southeast winds to 10. Rain tonight, at least an 80% chance of it, south winds to 15 tonight, low of 56. And rain tomorrow morning too, high near 63, southeast winds to 10, gusting to 20. Coming up on the Midday Report, Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center has built its own apartment complex for new employees. Alaska business experts say the ongoing child care crisis is hurting the state's employers and the economy. And a Kenai Peninsula man is asking the Alaska Department of Transportation to reconsider the use of salt brine on their roads.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Federal Reserve is warning that additional interest rate hikes are on the table. Speaking at an economic summit in Jackson Hole, Wyoming today, Fed Chair Jerome Powell said the central bank is not budging on its 2% inflation target.
We have tightened policy significantly over the past year. Although inflation has moved down from its peak, a welcome development, it remains too high. We are prepared to raise rates further if appropriate and intend to hold policy at a restrictive level until we are confident that inflation is moving sustainably down toward our objective.
Powell says the Fed's fight to lower inflation has challenged banks, pointing out that lending standards have tightened. The Kremlin is dismissing allegations that Russian President Vladimir Putin was behind the apparent death of Wagner mercenary leader Yevgeny Prigozhin in a plane crash outside Moscow this week. NPR's Charles Maines reports Russia was reacting to claims by the U.S. and other Western countries that Putin may have ordered his death.
Speaking to reporters, Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Western claims of Putin's involvement in the crash were, quote, absolute lies. Peskov noted there was lots of speculation around the crash and tragic deaths of people, including Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin, and implied the West was out to fan disinformation. Peskov also repeated calls from the Russian president for a full investigation into the incident. On Thursday, Putin expressed sympathies for the families of those killed and said initial reports suggested many were members of the Wagner mercenary group. The Russian president also appeared to eulogize Prigozhin, referring to him in the past tense without unequivocally stating the Wagner chief had died in the crash. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
When we think of damage caused by wildfire smoke, our minds normally just go to our lungs. But Megan Myskowski with member station KUNM reports that a new study from the University of New Mexico says our brains are also at risk.
The study says people with neurodegenerative diseases and mood disorders are potentially at higher risk of harm when there's poor air quality due to wildfires. UNM College of Pharmacy professor Matthew Campin says the new findings mean researchers need to keep thinking beyond the respiratory system when looking into the effects of smoke on our health.
What about the potential that depression can be worsened? What about the potential that concentration and your ability to think and process information can be impaired?
He says people can minimize risk by staying aware of air quality in their area and staying inside when there are high pollution levels. He also suggests limiting use of swamp coolers and wearing a mask on high pollution days. For NPR News, I'm Megan Myskowski.
This is NPR News in Washington.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. Providence Kodiak Island Medical Center has a solution for the island's housing shortage, building its own apartment complex for new employees. The first tenant has already signed a lease, and staff are holding a ribbon-cutting ceremony for the new housing development next week. KMXT's Brian Benoit got an early tour of the building and has this report.
The new units are on the edge of Providence's campus, just a short walk from the rest of the company's facilities. The building has been under construction for the last 2 years, but it's finally ready to open. Carl Hertz is the administrator at the medical center. He says housing has been one of the biggest challenges the hospital has faced when hiring new staff.
We had about 10 of them over the course of 2 or 3 months that called back and said, hey, we changed our mind. We can't come to Kodiak because we can't find housing. And so that was kind of the red flag that went up in our mind.
Providence already owned the lot, and funding for construction came through the company's operating budget. The building has 16 units. 4 of them have 2 bedrooms, and the rest have a single bedroom each. Apartments have basic furniture like couches, a dining table, beds, and each unit even has its own washer and dryer. Hertz says the goal is to make the move easier for prospective new hires.
This is designed for new caregivers who are relocating to the island as kind of a safe landing spot for them, so they know that they have a place to live while they look for their permanent home. And so they can rent this facility up to 12 months with approval.
Rent starts at $1,400 a month for the smaller apartments and includes all utilities except internet. Hertz says a big move is already daunting, let alone finding housing. When he first moved to the island 2 years ago, he had no idea how competitive the market here was.
I remember the anxiety far too well of this pressure of not only do I have to work and take care of the folks at the hospital, but my side hustle is looking online and trying to find an apartment complex.
Hertz says that while they may use some of the units to house temporary staff like traveling nurses, permanent staff will get first dibs. He says building temporary housing like this barely puts a dent in the island's market, but hopes other companies in town follow their lead to get more working professionals to the community.
I hope that this model might spark the interest or the imagination of some other providers in town or other industries in town. I know that it's difficult for all of our companies and organizations in town to recruit to Kodiak. It's just challenging.
Medical center staff will host a ribbon cutting and an open house for the public on Tuesday. The first tenant is scheduled to move in next month, and 4 more are already pending approval. In Kodiak, I'm Brian Benoit.
Alaska business experts say the ongoing child care crisis is hurting the state's employers and the economy.
This is a problem that is impacting their bottom line. It's impacting their ability to recruit and retain. It's impacting the morale and the happiness of the employee.
Katie Capozzi is president of the Alaska Chamber, the state's largest business advocacy group. She's also a member of the task force started by Governor Mike Dunleavy this year to address child care issues in the state.
We found that about $152 million are missing from the Alaskan economy because of people either choosing not to be in the workforce or working less.
She says that roughly a third of Alaska workers with children at home reported missing work in the last year because of child care issues. She attributes the problem to several factors, including a lack of available child care spots for children in urban areas and child care deserts for more rural Alaskans. Capozzi says for workers in the child care field, it's difficult to stay afloat, especially after the pandemic.
A lot of child care centers decided to close down over the pandemic, and they just haven't reopened. It is a broken business model. The child care center facility, even at home, is a broken business model, and so there's a lot of people who are just choosing not to take on that opportunity.
Capozzi says she's excited that the task force is taking on a, quote, true cost of child care study, close quote, to better understand how much it costs to run a child care facility and how to better support them in the future. A Central Peninsula man and many local automotive workers are asking the Alaska Department of Transportation to reconsider its use of salt brine on Kenai Peninsula roads, which they say makes them slick and can cause premature damage to vehicles. DOT says in response to those concerns that they'll look into the issue. The salt brine is a mixture of water with 23.3% sodium chloride. It's a pretreatment strategy that DOT uses for de-icing roads. Mike Arnold says he's been concerned about the road brine for years, since he observed its relationship to slick, icy roads. Then, he says, he started noticing damage like rust to his car. He also has environmental concerns about the runoff of brine into rivers, yards, and habitats. Arnold started a petition in March and began reaching out to automotive workers. Then he turned to the broader public. He says today the petition has more than 3,000 signatures. Once he started talking to automotive workers, Arnold says he developed other concerns about damage to airbags and brake lines.
And so I went to all the mechanic shops that I could find from Sterling to McKiskey, and I did that in one day. It took me all day long, and I had 60 professionals sign that petition just in this area.
Earlier this month, he presented the petition in front of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly and said thousands of locals want to see an end to the use of brine on DOT-managed roads. At the assembly meeting, local automotive workers also testified about the impacts they've observed on vehicles. Auto shop operator Robert Collins says the brine's corrosive nature can cause dangerous damage to safety features and has cost his customers thousands of dollars.
I have been in the automotive industry for 22 years and have seen my share of rust in the past, but moving to the peninsula the last 4 years, working as a manager of the local shop, I've seen more brake line failures, electrical failures, wire harness failures, frame failures than I've seen in 19 years.
Arnold's hope is that DOT will consider an alternative like the one used on Anchorage roads, which is warmed gravel without any salt. Later in the assembly meeting, DOT legislative liaison Andy Mills thanked Arnold and others for their testimony and said he would look into the issue. He said the department will begin with an internal review of the use of the substance.
The bottom line for DOT is we want to keep roads safe with sand and other mechanisms, but we also obviously need to listen to the community about the concerns that they have. So I would look forward again to the written comment and working with, again, local leadership and citizens there to try strategies that address those concerns.
Mills says that since that meeting, DOT has been doing internal research on how the salt brine is used by DOT and other entities in the state. He plans to present the agency's findings at the Assembly's September 19th meeting in Homer so that action can be taken before the winter season, if necessary. The Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project has long promised to bring North Slope natural gas to Nikiski for export to Asia. Optimism about the project among Alaska politicians has remained high despite the long timeline and the cost of the project. But last month, the Wall Street Journal reported that buyers in Japan and South Korea aren't confident in the project and don't plan to make investments or sign contracts. KDLL's Riley Board talked with River Davis, one of the reporters behind that journal story.
Could you start by telling me a little bit about what your job is and what you typically cover?
Yes, so I've been a reporter with the Wall Street Journal here in Tokyo, reporting out of Japan, covering Japanese businesses for the past 5 years. Most of the topics that I look at cover the automotive sector, and I also cover energy security and Japan's energy transition.
Interesting. And how did this particular story about the AK LNG project come to your attention?
Well, we were hearing a lot from Japanese companies and Korean companies as well that they were being approached by some political figures and people in the business world in Alaska, basically pitching contracts and deals to these companies, asking if they wanted to sign up to take Alaskan LNG. And so we started this project kind of very neutrally looking at sort of the trade-offs that are involved in the project. The positives, of course, being, you know, this is a project that could help with energy security and help Korea and Japan transition away from using Russian gas and oil. So that was kind of the positive energy security angle. Of course, on the other end, we were looking at climate issues. There's been, you know, some backlash about the project going forward, particularly a new fossil fuel project going forward in 2023. So that was the kind of stance we originally approached the story with. But once we did some reporting, we found that the story about how there wasn't a whole lot of interest in the project out of Asia, which were kind of the main target customers for the gas project, that became kind of the main angle that we discovered hadn't been told yet.
That's interesting that it started as one thing and evolved into another, and I'm curious if you could go into more detail about what sentiments you learned that people in those countries had about the project.
Yeah, so the sentiment specifically out of Japan, I would say, is that they felt that this project has been happening for a long time, and that it hasn't had much progress. So for Japan in particular, companies here, government officials, say that they want natural gas, you know, quite soon. In the next couple of years is when they're going to witness their worst pinch when it comes to supply. So the project's timeline is a little bit too far out for their wishes. And also because it has been kind of delayed for such a long time, they are a bit dubious about whether the project itself will actually get off the ground. Of course, it's a massive project, a massive investment. So those were just factors that they're considering. It's really important to companies here that if they do indeed sign up for a contract to offhand gas, that a project moves forward because they will give up other contracts elsewhere. So that security element, I think, was a large kind of off-putting factor for them.
Do these buyers have other options when it comes to getting natural gas on the timeline they're looking for?
They do. Of course, you know, Alaska officials, others kind of supporting the project would say that Alaska has a lot of benefits, of course, for Japan and Korea. It's just over a week to get natural gas shipped over here, and there's no kind of choke points that the gas has to go through that could be, you know, a potential security issue. But on the other hand, Japan thinks that it can get gas from other kind of secure projects. There's a lot of new supply coming to market, you know, around 2027, 2028, out of the U.S., Australia, Middle East. And so Japan sees it has a lot of options beyond just Alaska at this point.
In Alaska, you know, politicians are still very publicly optimistic about this project. You know, Lisa Murkowski voiced her optimism around here. She was visiting the Kenai Peninsula and expressing her optimism about the project as recently as last week. Why do you think that attitude is still prevalent over here, even as interest is waning in Asia?
I think, of course, you know, it's in the interest of people supporting the project to make sure that there's still kind of some optimism about it going forward. They're in the stage where they're looking for investment in the project. So I think if there's too much of kind of a dreary tone, that would be problematic. I do also get the sense that out of South Korea and Japan, perhaps there's a bit of information hasn't sort of traveled to Alaska in the way that perhaps it would in other situations. Talking to companies here, you know, they say, we're not interested in this project. But I'm not sure to what extent that kind of has been directly conveyed to people, you know, sitting locally in Alaska. Seems like there's a bit of an information divide there.
Do you think your story was one of the first ways that information was maybe conveyed in the U.S.?
I think there has been, you know, a decent amount of skepticism towards the project because it has taken kind of such a long time to move forward. And it's been, you know, eluding that final investment decision for some time now. So we did see other publications, you know, questioning whether it would be able to reach that final FID stage. But I think, you know, as a story that, you know, conveyed the voice of potential off-takers of gas, that being Japan, Korea, other countries in Asia, this was sort of one of the first stories that I've seen to convey that specific angle.
Well, thanks so much for joining me, River. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem at all.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter River Davis talking with KDLL's Riley Board about the Alaska LNG project and declining interest among Asian buyers. Wildlife troopers charged a Homer man this week with four counts of illegal fishing in un-Alaska waters. Bernardo Cherminoff is facing up to $4,500 in fines. Jeremy Baum is the Alaska wildlife trooper based in Unalaska. He says Cherminoff was using commercial fishing gear in an exclusively subsistence fishing area.
Our Department of Fish and Game and NOAA boarded the boat the next day, and there were 87 fish seized off that vessel.
Only residents can participate in subsistence fisheries, and they have to have permits to fish. Cherminoff was fishing in Reese Bay, which is about 18 miles by boat from Unalaska. It's best known for its midsummer sockeye or red salmon run. Baum says Cherminoff was cited for not having a subsistence permit to participate in that fishery and for unlawful possession of subsistence fish, also for operating a subsistence fishing net that was longer than the legal maximum length, and for failing to report commercially caught fish on his fish ticket.
At the time of the boarding, and according to Mr. Cherminoff, some of the fish that were on board were from his subsistence catch in Reese Bay, but there was also additional fish he claims on board his vessel that were commercial caught. Those fish were not recorded on a fish ticket, as he's required to do.
Cherminoff has a court date set for September.
Another U.S. official heads to China to talk trade. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo heads to China this weekend. The message from the Biden administration is that the U.S. is not seeking to decouple from China. Still, trade between the two countries has declined by 20% in the first half of the year. Whirlpool has agreed to pay a $12 million fine for failing to immediately report that some 26,000 glass cooktops are fire hazards because they can turn on by themselves. Regulators say the company got more than 150 customer reports. Whirlpool denied wrongdoing. And the Federal Aviation Administration is considering tighter rules for charter air carriers. Airline unions say the companies are skirting safety regulations. I'm Nova Safo with the Marketplace Minute.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the 25th day of August, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 6:55. It will set again at 9:26, giving us 14 hours and 31 minutes of glorious daylight. A loss of 4 minutes and 49 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high for this date was 78 degrees set in 1959, and our record low is 39 degrees set in 2009. Currently a perfectly pleasant 60 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. East winds at 7 miles per hour at the airport, where they are also reporting 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for a 50% chance of rain for the rest of the day, and mostly cloudy skies with a high near 61, southeast winds to 10, and rain for tonight, at least an 80% chance of it, low around 56 overnight with south winds to 15. Rain tomorrow morning too, at least until 2 p.m., high around 63, south winds to 10, gusting to 20. And for Sunday, 40% chance of rain, Monday, 40% chance of rain. Well, let's check in with the brand spanking new announcement from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 38, date issued 10:30 a.m. on August 25th. The following areas will be extended for 48 hours from 6 p.m. Sunday, August 26th to 6 p.m. Monday, August 28th. The Duck Bay, Iziut Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections of the Afognak District. As previously announced, the following areas are currently scheduled to close at 6 p.m. Saturday, August 26th. The Inner Karluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Northwest Afognak, Raspberry Strait sections of the Afognak District, the Mainland District, and the Cape Alitak, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District. The following areas are open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. The Outer Iqaluk, Outer Karluk, Sturgeon, and Halibut Bay sections of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Northwest Kodiak District, except for the Uyak Bay and Inner Uganic Bay sections, remain closed. The Northeast Kodiak District, the East Side Kodiak District, the Humpy Deadman section of the Alitak District, and the Southwest Afognak and Northeast Afognak sections of the Afognak District. Close waters are reduced from noon Thursday, August 24th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 26th in the following areas. At Karluk Lagoon's exit channel terminus at the ocean shoreline, stream number 255101. Closed waters are expanded until further notice in that portion of the southwest Fognak section of the Afognak District within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 252105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. Until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse and gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations. And statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Mariners, here is your weather forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory for tonight and tomorrow. For today, south 20, seas to 6 feet, south 25 tonight with 8-foot seas, and south 30 tomorrow with 9-foot seas. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory for tonight and tomorrow as well, south 20 becoming east 15 in the afternoon today, 5-foot seas coming down to 3 feet this afternoon, but tonight, southeast 20 increasing to 30 after midnight, and seas to 5 feet. For tomorrow in the Shelikof, south 25 and 5-foot seas. We have an outgoing tide. Our next low tide here on the east side will be at 2:13 this afternoon and be 3.8 feet, followed by a high tide at 8:56, just about 9 p.m., of 8.2 feet. Over on the west side, your low tide will happen at 2:54 p.m. and be 5.7 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 9:29 p.m. of 12.2 feet. Doughboy over on Near Island is having a pop-up fundraiser today for the people impacted by the Maui wildfire. That's going on all the way till 8 p.m. It's happening right now. It's over on Alamec Drive on Near Island. Several businesses are matching the funds which will be raised, and they will be donated directly to the Maui Strong Fund through the Hawaii Community Foundation, which is waiving all fees to get 100% of the funds to the people who need them. So if you feel hungry and would like to do something good for the Maui wildfire victims, that Doughboy pop-up fundraiser is going on till 8 p.m. over on Near Island.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
Kodiak, and welcome to the August 25th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Hello, darkness, my old friend. While some of us are bemoaning the return of dark night skies, others of us are celebrating the return of star-filled nights. But whether you choose to sleep through them or gaze in awe at them, dark night skies and nighttime officially return to Kodiak around August 15th. From about 12:30 to 4 a.m. right now is what is astronomically known as nighttime. But the sky is really dark enough by 10:30 or 11 to really enjoy the stars. So head out to your deck or your backyard for a moment or two before going to bed and gaze up. It's a peaceful way to end your day. On Wednesday, the 30th, we'll all get to enjoy a blue supermoon, a pretty rare event. It happens when a blue moon, the second full moon in a month, happens to be a supermoon, which is when there is a full moon while the moon is closest to the Earth in its orbit. That magic happens for us on Wednesday, August 30th. Moonrise will be at 9:40 p.m., and it could well be a colorful blue moon because it follows the sunset by a few minutes. It's well worth the effort to watch it, if the skies are not completely cloudy, of course. The next time we'll have a blue supermoon is in 9 years, in 2032. There's a family-friendly Audubon hike on some of the Fort Abercrombie trails this Saturday. As with all Audubon hikes, meet your hike leader at 9:30 a.m. at the ferry terminal downtown. Kids of all ages are welcome, accompanied by a parent, of course, and then enjoy a nice 2-mile walk through the magical forest and meadows of Fort Abercrombie. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.